Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to this very special spoiler podcast for The Dark Knight Rises. This isn't a review, per se, for that. You must download this week's Empire podcast proper, which includes an interview with Chris Nolan, or you can head to the Empire website for Nev Pierce's written take on Chris Nolan's trilogy Ender. Instead, this will be a discussion of some of the film's major talking points, and I'm joined by Nick DeSemlian.
Bat hello.
James Dyer.
I am Empire's reckoning.
And Empire's bat guru, Dan Jolin.
Hello, Chris.
Hello, Dan. Now, we're not going to go freeform. Instead, we asked you for your questions, your theories, and your plot holes, and you sent them in their droves. First one comes from Jack Gregson, and he says, after Bruce emerges from the pit, how on earth did he get back to Gotham? He was in a foreign land, had no money, the city was in total lockdown, he was gadgetless, and yet he just swaggers up to Catwoman and gives no explanation. How?
EasyJet.
Yes, clearly.
Bat credit card.
So he uses a bat credit card to rent an EasyJet plane.
He's a very resourceful man.
With no passport and no money. And even if he had money, he wouldn't have money because he's bankrupt.
Yes, but he has no money or passport at the beginning of Batman Begins, and yet somehow he manages to travel the world learning how to become a criminal or in order to fight crime. So he's very, very resourceful. He lives in the shadows of a cargo hold plane, presumably.
Yeah.
How does he get into Gotham then?
Swims.
He walks across the ice.
Yeah. More importantly, how does he find Selina Kyle, who's randomly talking to children on a bridge?
Well, this is the thing about Batman throughout all three films. How does he find anyone at any point when people need him? You know, there's a moment in The Dark Knight where he's in one place one minute, and then he knows when Harvey Dent takes that guy from when Commissioner Gordon's apparently killed at the funeral for Commissioner Loeb, and then Harvey Dent takes that guy, that nut job, and drives him away in the ambulance, and then he's about to kill him using the coin. To decide whether he's going to kill him or not. And then Batman just turns up out of nowhere. How does he know where Harvey Dent is?
I believe they all have Find My Friends on their iPhone.
They must do.
On a side note, I did enjoy the moment where Selina Kyle disappears when talking to Batman.
Yes. He goes, that's what that feels like.
I like that. That was funny.
That was good.
The last moment of sly humour.
He keeps the bat voice even when there's no one else listening.
I love that.
He talks to himself in the Batman voice.
No, I love that because Batman is a distinct personality for him. The minute he puts a mask on, he's not Bruce Wayne anymore, he's Batman. Which is very different from pretty much any other masked superhero. When Tony Stark puts on the Iron Man armor, he's still Tony Stark. When Peter Parker puts on the Spider-Man mask, he's part of his personality is freed and he's a little bit more wisecracky, but he's still Peter Parker. But once Bruce Wayne dons the mask, Bruce Wayne ain't there no more.
Yeah,
cool. Okay, so second question. Did we answer that?
Well, there's a certain level on which these films operate that you've just got to absolutely accept. They're not reality. I mean, you know, Nolan always aims to keep things as close as possible to reality because that's his style and that's his take on this universe. But they're not reality. I mean, Batman's going to turn up where he's going to be needed.
That did bring me out of the film a little bit when he just randomly sauntered up to Selina Kyle at this point, because there's a few bits like that around this point in the film.
Well, my feeling is that he's set up so much stuff around Gotham, clearly, as the ending shows, that he might have been in Gotham for a day or so already, so he might have had time to track people. And he's very, very good at it. He is the world's greatest detective, after all, so why wouldn't he know where Selina Kyle is? Sorted.
Yes.
Tick. Done. Tick.
Tick.
Okay, next question is from Daniel Gaze, and he says, for the love of Batman, please don't lend credence to the theories about the end cafe scene being all in Alfred's head. It's not. This isn't Inception. This isn't a dream within a dream within a dream. For a start, Selina Kyle is there, who Alfred had little interaction with throughout the film, and therefore would certainly not imagine being with Bruce. And then the next question is from Gary Hall. He says, my theory in the Dark Knight Rises ending is that Alfred was imagining Bruce there and was having a wish fulfillment daydream. So a lot of this is gaining a lot of traction. This,
well, if you look
Alfred
very carefully at the
it.
Table, you can see the top still spinning.
Very good point. A lie, I'm guessing, obviously. But what do we think? I'm very much in the it was not a dream camp. In fact, I'm a bit flummoxed that there is a dream camp.
I've got to say, when I saw it, I thought that Nolan was deliberately putting some ambiguity in there. I didn't think it was this clear cut. Maybe that's just me.
I agree with Nick. I think there is some deliberate ambiguity. I think he's almost deliberately riffing on the end of Inception in a way. He certainly has a feel of it. And Michael Caine's presence there in the way that he had that presence at the end of Inception. But, I mean, you know, hold a gun to my head. Which way do I think it goes? I think he did survive. Mm-hmm. I think there are other clues at mm-hmm. the end there. For example, the clue about the autopilot. Yes. I mean, Nolan, you know, the thing is what he's always done in his films is, you know, that kind of the illusionist kind of parallel, where what he's doing is he's distracting in a way. He's pointing you in a certain direction whilst actually showing you stuff as he's going along. So if you go back to his films, you can see all along what he's setting up. But at the time, you know, the first time you see them, you're looking where he wants you to look. So in this film, I think there are a lot of things that are set up very well. For example, the Talia reveal is actually set up very well. If you go back to the film, you can see very clearly that she's manipulating things.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
she appears in places where she shouldn't, but you don't realise she was there until you go back and see the film again. So in that sense, I think he's very much set up this idea of Bruce surviving at the end and establishing Joseph Gordon-Levitt, John Blake, as his successor.
Absolutely.
On a side note, do we think that they were a bit annoyed when they saw the Avengers and saw that this had kind of been done as the ending for a film already this year?
So the Avengers ends basically, if you haven't seen the Avengers, cover your ears, but you have by now, everyone has. The Avengers ends with a billionaire playboy hero suddenly deciding to take responsibility and saving the souls of millions of people by flying a nuclear bomb away from the city. And then 2 months later, The Dark Knight Rises ends in exactly the same way.
And they obviously both stole it from season 2 of 24, in which Mason rides a nuclear bomb into the desert. Awesome.
Sandra Berkeley always leads the way.
I would say there are significant differences between the two endings. Just saying.
In what way?
They don't go for
Batman didn't fly his nuclear bomb through an interdimensional rift.
Also,
no, true.
Did anyone really think Tony Stark was dead, even for a second?
Oh, of course not.
Given that they'd already greenlit the next Iron Man film.
Given that he was about to film it,
yeah. Batman wasn't saved by a rampaging green monster.
If he had been.
If you look closely at the end, Bruce Wayne and Selina Kyle eating shawarma at the cafe.
True, but the one thing for me gives credence to the it was a dream theory is the fact that Batman is this great hero, very heroic character, and there's a moment of noble self-sacrifice at the end where he flies this bomb away from Gotham. We're meant to believe then that he fakes his death and leaves Gotham to deal with the fallout from a nuclear bomb, because if the wind's blowing the wrong way, then in 20 years time it's going to be a lot of people with two heads running around the streets of Gotham. About 1,000 psychotic criminals, including, we have to assume, the Joker, still loose on the streets of Gotham. He just goes, yeah, I'm going off on holiday.
To live off the ill-gotten gains of a cat burglar.
Well, I presume he has offshore accounts.
It's a big assumption.
It's a huge assumption to make, but it's a bigger assumption to make that Bruce Wayne would
maybe they flogged
would benefit
the
from a life of crime. So there you go.
He has set up a successor, hasn't he? The idea that the Batman can continue without Bruce Wayne.
Yes, but a Batman with no training.
But technically, he
Bruce
has
Wayne
had
trained for years to become Batman.
Well, okay, John Blake isn't League of Shadows, you know, trained. Yeah. But I would say he earned his stripes.
He certainly has earned his stripes. Yeah. But I still think, you know, is it a bit cowardly of Bruce Wayne, if he's still alive? I don't know, I'm just saying, you turn your back on your city when it's being devastated by nuclear fallout and bad guys. But anyway, I personally,
Selina Kyle says,
cannot,
you've given enough, and he says not everything, not yet.
That's true.
Maybe he has, that's the time he goes, you know what, that's it.
But anyway, I just cannot believe it. I think people are wanting to see a tricksy it was all a dream ending because of Chris Nolan's past work. I think this is a very, very straightforward ending. Batman, Bruce Wayne fakes his death, he sends messages to his confidants. So obviously he shows up in front of Alfred in Florence, which, you know, Alfred tips off very early in the film. He sends a message to Commissioner Gordon in the form of the fixed bat signal, which means Gary Oldman's last shot in this trilogy is basically him capering around like and clapping his hands. I'm so happy. He sends the bag with the coordinates to the Batcave to John Blake or Robin, and he repairs the autopilot on the bat for Lucius Fox. So the signals are there. I mean, it's very, very clear that he's planning to be alive, and he's planning to still be alive and tell people he's alive. I honestly don't see the dream thing at all.
I just think maybe the implication is that it's not so much a dream as just wishful thinking by Alfred.
the rambling hallucinations of an old man. Okay, I don't quite see that, but okay, fair enough. It seems to be gaining some momentum, that theory. Okay, Amanda.
I think it's good. I mean, you know, that it's not so just clear cut and this is what it is, and people are able to bring their own interpretations and thoughts to it and see different things in it, and that's That's why we love Nolan's film, isn't it? Isn't it?
Yeah. Next up, Amanda Bostock says her first point was the Talia Bane revelation. Given how prominent Bane had been up until that point and how well he'd been put forward as the villain, I felt that the unfailing of Talia cheapened what the majority of the film so far had achieved. Also, Bane's death was a chronic waste. Thoughts?
I don't know that it cheapened him. I think it felt a little anticlimactic the way he died. Although it was a nice gag, it did feel a little bit...
I thought he was going to come back and jump out of a manhole or something like that.
At the end of Die Hard.
It didn't seem like the ending,
that you envisioned for him. No.
Fits that guy who's this invincible.
But the reveal did give rise to, I think, one of the nicest moments, which is that shot of Bane when she's fixing his mouth with the tears in his eyes, which I actually thought was quite a nice sort of moment of characterisation for him. So I would have been sorry to not have that.
And Talia's reveal echoes the first movie as well, where we think the Scarecrow is the main villain, and then suddenly at the end...
Those Al Ghuls are tricksy people.
They are very tricksy people, and they hide in plain sight. Dan, what was your take on this one?
It's funny, actually, because having done all the research for the feature and done all the interviews, and no one ever told me anything in terms of plot revelations. But it was funny, I'd kind of figured it out before I saw it the first time. So in a weird way, I was sort of looking for it, but trying not to look for it. So when it did happen the first time I saw the film, I actually didn't have the impact it should have on me. And that's my problem. I bought that baggage.
It was all out there anyway, though, wasn't it?
I think
I'd read the Robin thing and the Talia thing online about a year ago.
But most people aren't looking for that, you know. And I would think most people listening to this podcast wouldn't have wanted to look for that. You know, we don't like spoilers, we try to avoid it. You know, in the position I was in, it would have been remiss of me not to go seeking that stuff out. But the second time I saw the film, it's kind of like, I got out of the way, now let's just sit back and enjoy it, knowing what I know. And I loved the way the Talia revelation was handled. I referred to earlier about, you know, the clues that are dropped in along the way. You know, like, for example, when Gordon says to her... she comes up and she offers her help to him, and he gives her the little Geiger counter thingy or whatever, and she gives him a thumbs up, it's in that truck. And then shortly afterwards he opens it and it's empty, and that's a big clue, but I think a lot of people might not have even have spotted at that point. Or every time after Bane takes over Gotham, she pops up shortly after, the place is filled with League of Shadows people. So she's obviously got some kind of panic button that she's using to call on them. So those special forces guys, she kills them.
Yeah.
That's her.
Yeah.
But when you first see it, you don't see that. There's even a wonderful shot of her looking out down on the street where the big battle's taking place. And you see her face and you see sort of like guns behind her, sort of poking in the edge of the frame, as if to infer that she's being held hostage. But actually, if you look at it again, she's being flanked by her men. So I really liked the way that was handled. Did it cheapen Bane? I don't know. I have no great love for the character in terms of its comic book heritage, so I only really treated it in terms of who he was in this film. It did remind me a lot of The World Is Not Enough.
In what way?
Spoiler warning for The World Is Not Enough. In the way it sets up Robert Carlyle as the bad guy, who is a deadly man who is crippled in a strange way, except he's different. He doesn't feel pain, but he's slowly dying.
Yeah.
And then its big reveal is that he's actually the henchman of the real villain, who is the Bond girl, who is Sophie Marceau.
That is true. Who knew it would be so influential?
Yeah, so there you go.
And obviously the beginning of this film is very similar to License to Kill, with the two-plane stunt. Although it's a helicopter in License to Kill.
That's true. There's a strong executive decision vibe as well at the beginning of this movie.
There always is.
And cliffhanger indeed.
Who would have thought Christopher Nolan would be influenced by Bond movies? We haven't seen that, have we, in his work?
Were there any other Bond touchstones in this movie?
In this one? Talking about the opening section, it actually reminded me of The Living Daylights to some degree, which was another great aerial stunt.
Yes, there's actually a moment just before Bond flies off where you see a pigeon do a double take. you keep your eyes open for that.
Before Bond flies off?
Yes.
It's a massive crossover, is it?
It is, yeah.
All right, okay. But in one scene.
There's a very important cameo, actually, at the very beginning of the film, and it's not Aidan Gillen.
Okay, I'm going to bite. Who is it?
It's Cardington Studios.
Cardington Studios.
Yeah, yeah. They shot that very opening scene outside Cardington Studios. You can see two huge hangars behind the plane at the beginning of the film.
Can you?
And they're absolutely gigantic hangars. Yeah, yeah, yeah. They were originally built to build airships.
Yeah.
And inside those hangars is, or was, I don't know the state of them now, but the Narrows from Batman Begins.
Okay.
And they built the rotating hotel scene from Inception in there as well.
Wow.
Yeah.
So a big
They should totally open that up like the Harry Potter sort of thing.
Yeah, but that, they should, but I don't know. I don't know.
Nolan kind of, world.
Yeah, I don't know whether the upkeep was to the degree that it had been with the Harry Potter films.
They should have Jonah Nolan on standby just to bring people around and show them, you know, be a tour guide. That'd be awesome. Bernard Kelly says, John Blake's name being Robin was a bit silly.
Oh, come on. That's just a gag. That's a good gag. I like
it. A gag too far?
No. There's this whole thing with you know, the repeated phrase that comes up is, you know, look, viewing the Batman universe through the Nolan prism. You know, they talk about it with...
Yes, I'm always saying that.
Yes. You know, so Heath Ledger's Joker, you know, was through the Nolan prism, and they've done Bane and they've done Catwoman now, brilliantly, I should add, because we haven't talked about her yet. But yeah, this was just... How close can you possibly get to Robin in the Nolan verse of Batman? And this is about as close as you can get. So I kind of like that little gag, you know. Because they were never going to do Robin.
Mm.
And this was just their little kind of, you know, if we were, that's who he was.
True.
Would it have been slightly less heavy-handed if he'd said his real name was Dick Grayson instead of my real name is Robin?
Maybe. Maybe. But, again, he and Warner Brothers don't just make these films for people that know the comic books inside out. Or remember the TV show from the 60s. You know, there are a lot of people out there, you know... kids and fully grown people who, you know, don't know every aspect of the lore of this, of the canon, if you like. Mm. So, but they know about Batman and Robin.
So Robin is shorthand, yeah.
Yeah.
And I guess this is the best way you could introduce a Robin. I mean, he doesn't do anything cheesy. He doesn't say, holy rusted metal, Batman,
yes,
at any point. He doesn't do anything stupid. He is a little bit weak in the film at times, though. He doesn't really... I mean, he overpowers those two guys at the building site.
Mm, just.
Just about. Mm. With the aid of a lucky deflection. And then he throws his gun away. Ah! I'm a cop. I've just killed someone. Ah! What is this? But otherwise, he just tends to get overpowered a bit, goes back to my earlier point, is if this is the beginning of a... And we're going to discuss this now, I guess. Can you see a Joseph Gordon-Levitt-led spin-off, or will it be a fourth Batman, not with Nolan at the helm, but with maybe Joseph Gordon-Levitt as Nightwing?
I foundly hope not.
You think not?
I really hope not. It's going to be one of those things, isn't it? I mean, Dan, you may be able to answer this. I would have thought that they would have locked Joseph Gordon-Levitt into some kind of contract. Should they wish to do it, you can guarantee Nolan wouldn't do it. But since this is undoubtedly going to make quite a lot of money, they're going to have to be tempted, aren't they?
Yeah, I don't. I didn't take it as being a sequel bait, further sequel bait at all. I just took it as it's just a neat ending.
Yeah,
Bruce Wayne and Nolan's always said this. This is Bruce Wayne's story. He never said this is the end of his Bruce Wayne story. Mm-hmm. He was quite specific. He didn't actually say this was the end of his Batman story. But I like the way that he's constructed it as a trilogy about Bruce Wayne, but left this note at the end to say that the Batman legend can continue even though Bruce Wayne is out of the game now. And I just think that's all it's doing, really.
I think what you're saying there is absolutely right in terms of what we would like to think, and certainly what Nolan would think. But given the cynicism of the studio money-making machine, do you think they wouldn't have thought maybe there's a way to wring more dollars out of this franchise?
I think they will, but they'll just do it with another reboot.
We can but hope.
Yeah. I mean, I think Warner Brothers has always been... Well, thus far, being very respectful of, you know, Nolan's creative vision, and, you know, God knows that his creative visions have worked out well for Warner Brothers. So I can't imagine there being a kind of, hey, you know what, you know, let's carry it on.
The Batman legacy.
Even if Chris doesn't want to.
But what would the Robin film be? Does he use gadgets? I don't know. He couldn't just use Batman's gadgets, could he?
Well, that's the thing.
Robin mobile?
There's no more money, is there, really? Mm. I mean, you know, Lucius Fox, he could still go to Lucius Fox because he knows that Lucius Fox knows about Batman and Bruce Wayne. But where's the money to fund all those incredible toys that he has? Who knows? It may not be a Batman film. We know that Robin in the comics becomes Nightwing, who's just as badass. In fact, he is Batman in the comics now, but they could go down that route. I kind of hope they don't. But it's very nice at the end of the film, the last shot of the film is literally the new Dark Knight rising as the platform brings Joseph Gordon-Levitt up and out of shot. Very, very nice little touch, I thought. Yeah. But yeah, so Bernard Kelly also has a couple of other questions. He says, near the end, when the orphans are on the bus looking at the bat fly off into the distance, one of the kids is wearing a glove with a picture of a harlequin stitched into it. Are we meant to read anything into that? Is that a Joker reference? Is that the one Joker reference in the film? Or is it a harlequin?
No, I don't think it is, really. Okay. I didn't spot that myself.
You've seen it twice now, yeah?
Yeah, but I totally didn't spot that, to be honest. I can't think that there's any significance there, and if there was, then it would have been more obvious, wouldn't
Absolutely,
it?
Absolutely, I think so. Harry Stainer wants to know what our favourite scene was from the film. His was the first fight between Bane and Batman. The whole audience gasped when they thought Bane had broken his back. Well, he did break his back. But yes, James, you got a favourite one from this movie?
I did like that scene as well. I think that's a really nice one. It's an interesting one because Batman up until that point has been sort of the master of everyone he fights. I mean, he's an unparalleled sort of close combat fighter, and Bane just shrugs off everything he throws at him. And it's also interesting because you know that Batman is far from at the top of his physical condition. He's sort of weakened, he's in pain, he's got, you know, various cybernetics keeping him standing upright, and then he goes against this sort of machine who just beats him mercilessly. Really nice, and it makes Batman feel more human, I think, that scene does. So yeah, I think that's mine too.
Dan?
My favourite scene actually is a Selina Kyle scene. Mm-hmm. It's the one where she turns up at the bar with the, was it senator or congressman?
Congressman.
She turns up at the bar with the congressman to do that deal. And I just love the way she, you know, goes into action and takes out all those guys in that room. And you've got to remember, I mean, for Christopher Nolan, this the character's a first. It's a woman who kicks men's asses. But my favourite specific bit is then when the cops burst in, when she just falls on the floor and starts screaming.
Yes.
And it's just, that's just a perfect interpretation of that character. She knows how to use her sex and sexuality to manipulate dumb men around her who yeah. are sort of like, you know, fueled with testosterone, and she just completely, the way she controls and manipulates that situation.
She's so good.
Yeah, and Hathaway is just absolutely brilliant, I think.
Could I just give a great respect to the Gotham Police Department, whose response time to a Trace text message was less than 1 minute. Astonishing. Astonishing.
In force as well.
Maybe they were all running into a nearby sewer at the time.
Well, it was a bar, so perhaps that's where they were headed anyway.
That wasn't the greatest bit of police work.
They are the Keystone Cops.
Yeah. Bane's in the sewers. Let's send every cop in Gotham into
if they see a dark foreboding tunnel, they will all run into it.
Well, it's because Gary Oldman was leaving them. Who should we send? Everyone! And that was it.
Nick, what was your favourite
scene? My favourite scene was the arrival of Batman after the stock exchange sequence, when he turned up on the bat pod and all the cops start chasing him. And I just thought that was incredible filmmaking. Yeah. Just the amount of police cars. It reminded me a bit of Blues Brothers. I loved it. And then the bat. It's not the bat wing, is it? It's just called
the bat.
Yeah. The first time you see that whole sort of 15 minute sequence. Amazing.
Yeah, that's great. I love that Batman's reintroduction. It's a very iconic one with the lights fading down and suddenly he comes out in the Batpod. Good sound effect, by the way.
You're in for a show tonight, son.
Absolutely, Brent Briscoe.
There's a bit of a tradition in the Nolan Batman films of policemen during chase sequences saying stupid things.
Well, Nicky Kett in The Dark Knight.
That's a favourite of mine.
That's a very Bondian tradition. Mm. You know, especially in the Roger Moore films, you know, there's a whole series of stupid cops saying things. My favourite scene was Selina Kyle's introduction, where she goes from being dowdy maid to oops, cat burglar in the blink of an eye. Yeah. She's very, very good. And then the bit where Batman announces his return to Gotham with the when Commissioner Gordon lights a flare and lights it up and the bat symbol appears.
Fight Club.
Really, good point.
Yeah. Oh, that was the point made actually in our review, Neff Pierce's review, so I'm stealing that point from him.
Yeah, no, it is. It's a great moment. And the second time I saw it was with the proper audience instead of stuffy film critics, and they got it. You know, that was a round of applause moment. Syed Bugaloo says, "Hi, small, probably pointless observation I saw when Selina was apprehended in the airport. There was an EasyJet airplane in the background. Who knew EasyJet could now fly to Gotham?"
It's £400 return, but it's £100 for every additional suitcase.
Well, Bruce Wayne has a lot of baggage, so.
That's true. That's why he's got no money left.
Come on.
It's good.
Imagine on the cost. Yeah, and I noticed that as well. Because that airport scene is filmed at, I guess, Stansted. It's Stansted, isn't it?
Yeah, they shot at Stansted.
Because I was looking at it going, I know the airport. I've trodden that faintly disappointing carpet before. And it's like, oh yeah, that's it, that's Stansted. And I was just looking around, that's an EasyJet plane, which is a bit of a, I guess, a bit of a mistake for Nolan to keep in.
I seen the film twice and I didn't spot it.
Well, it's so bright orange, so it's hard to miss.
I wasn't looking for it.
And also I spotted another blooper a second time I saw the film, whenever Bruce is looking at Selena Kyle's records at the beginning of the film, and some newspaper headlines come up, and one of those headlines, the word heist is incorrently spelled.
Really?
H I-E-S-T that, is how they spell it.
That was The Guardian.
The Gotham Guardian. Mm.
And Dan, you were saying earlier there's someone, a figure to keep your eye out for during the battle on the street.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's right. That's because they shot that on Wall Street in New York. And there's this particular tramp in New York who, I think they just call him the radio guy or something like that, who's, he's this old man. He's always got a little old school 80s radio around his neck. And on Wall Street, you know, in New York, they couldn't stop the public from going through. They have right of way. So they just let this tramp wander through. He is in one shot. As Bane's men are lining up on one side and the policemen are lining up on the other, you can see this sort of confused tramp staring around with a radio around his neck.
Adam Fox, who's presumably no relation of Lucius, or he might be, asks a couple of plot hole questions. Why didn't they blow up the bomb right after Dr. Pavel arms it?
You can explain that, because Bane's plot was to torture Batman.
Yes.
With the, you know, the 6 months of watching this and, yes, and not be able to save Gotham. Do you remember the 60s Batman movie when Batman's trying to defuse a bomb and he's running around the street?
That's just like a bowling ball with a fuse on the top of it.
With the ducklings and the nuns. I would have loved to have seen a repetition of that.
Well, actually, that's another scene in which Batman runs off with a bomb and you think he's dead.
Oh my gosh.
That's right. So Dark Knight Rises references the original Batman movie.
Kapow!
Who knew Chris Nolan had it in him? Mm. Do you think he's seen the 1966 Batman?
Well, he actually, not the last time I went to his edit suites, his place in Hollywood, but the time before, there was a poster for it, the original Batman, hanging up.
Really?
In the reception area. Yes.
Wow. Okay.
Yes.
Cool. Adam Fox has another question. He says, why did the guys in the pit torture Bruce Wayne by showing him the TV and then help him heal and escape?
Well, they weren't controlling the TV.
They weren't controlling the TV.
Who knows the mind of Tom Conti? Unfathomable.
Yeah, that did make a whole world of sense, because they were going on about, it's Bane's prison now.
Yes.
Make a great deal of sense. And and suddenly they help him out and hang him off the ceiling. And
you think Bane, if it's Bane's prison, he'd have installed some security cameras or...
Yes.
Isn't there a kind of argument that the reason why that's one of the worst prisons is because there's always hope of escape.
There's always hope of escape in a prison.
So they obviously, it's in the, you know, Bane or whoever runs the prison's interest to give people the idea that they could possibly get out by watching people trying to get out and then falling down again.
Mm-hmm. The thing about that is, I would, if I was Bruce Wayne, I'd take Tom Conti with me, because that guy is...
He throws the rope down.
He's a medical miracle. Vertebrae hanging out of your back? No problem. I'll just punch it back in. And you're back on your feet within a month. Easy. No paralysis here.
This podcast is very disrespectful.
I'm not disrespectful. I'm just saying.
Can I just say, with the Bane voice, it was an interesting one, because everyone seems to have a different opinion of what it was. Half the office seemed to think it was a very public school-esque posh English accent. I thought it was supposed to be a bit German, a bit Dutch, something like that, a bit European.
Hmm.
Tom Hardy came out and said it was based on this bare-knuckle fighter. What was his name? I've got it written down. Bartley Gorman, who was apparently Romany. Not Mitt Romney, obviously, because that would be silly. But
well, he's already associated with Bane,
yes,
anyway.
Indeed.
He definitely has a Romanian... somebody whose name originally comes from Romania, I can tell you.
Well, there we go.
It's got a bit of a Dracul vibe to it.
Your punishment must be much more severe.
More severe.
That's true. There is a Lugosi vibe going on.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, so, I just think he was older. That's what I liked about it. It was the voice of an older man, because it's almost a clue that Bane is an older man than we are expecting.
Gotham's
interesting
reckoning.
That Nolan dropped the whole Venom... plot where Bane has venom injected into his body.
Yeah,
because that's silly.
That is a bit silly.
But he relooped all the dialogue. Didn't he go through a point after people had seen the original footage by saying, it's fine, we're not changing it? Or am I making that up?
There was,
because he clearly did redo all the dialogue.
Was it a statement released, or was it
a rumour?
That's
rumours going around.
Because you can tell it was redone, because you could understand
Dan,
what he said.
Call him now.
Call the Batphone.
It was never officially confirmed by anybody. I can only say that, having seen the prologue and then having watched it again twice as part of the film, it did seem clear. Higher in the mix.
Oh, it's much clearer.
Just higher in the mix. That's all I will say. But no one officially confirmed it either way.
I did not have any trouble understanding what he was saying in it, actually.
No,
maybe one line, but then I struggled to hear a couple of lines of other characters. But Bane I didn't have a problem with.
Yeah, I think it was easier to understand in this film than the Scarecrow was in Batman Begins.
Mm. Yep.
I still have problems with some of his dialogue.
Mm. Yeah.
Talking of Bane, I loved Aidan Gillen's small part in the film, in the prologue. His kind of cockiness and just the way he sort of stands with his hands on his hips and that stuff like that. I thought he was terrific.
Yeah.
He's great. He's
really,
great.
Really good. One thing I didn't quite get was, I mean, this is a very bloodless film. A lot of people get killed in the film, and you know, obviously to have a PG-13 rating, same with The Dark Knight, there's not a lot of blood being shown. But doesn't he kill the guy in the plane at the beginning of the film? But he fires a gun
he
to the side of...
He pretends to kill them. He's pretending to kill them to make the other guys talk, which is why Bane has that line... He's wondering why you're shooting people before throwing them out of a plane.
He's
CIA. He's behaving.
I did not get
he
that.
Out of the head. Yep.
There's a point about Aidan Gillen, though, because obviously he's in The Wire. He's from The Wire. There's another actor from The Wire as well who appears in a small role. Robert Wisdom.
Bunny.
Yes, who plays Bunny. And Nolan is a fan of The Wire.
Where does he appear?
The first general on the bridge when Bane's right-hand man goes out and says, "You will help us keep all the people in Gotham, or we will blow the place up."
Oh, really? Do you think that's a sly in-joke that the guy who was responsible for Hamsterdam
is now responsible for us?
The new Hamsterdam. Yeah.
So is Nolan also a fan of Stargate? The
TV series?
Christopher
Judge, isn't it? Yeah,
I'm not so sure about that.
He's called all the merchandise.
I'm now completely lost. This is where James lives. James lives in the Stargate shadows.
And Bane's right-hand man, the guy who obviously hands him over to Aidan Gillen, is what's his chops from Jamie from Blue Bloods.
What's his chops?
Which I believe is his official IMDb character name.
Do we think there were too many characters in this? Do we think we needed Juno Temple as Selina Kyle's sidekick?
I love the fact that the Nolan verse is so studded with. Mm. You know, it feels real and lived in. Mm. There are
like
many characters everywhere. Yeah. I quite liked it. It gives Selina Kyle a life beyond the film. I think
there were hints that she was bisexual.
That's what I was about to say.
Dan, you read that into everything.
you've written some fanfic, some slash fiction on this, haven't you, Dan?
50 Shades
no,
of Gotham.
No, but I will.
Samantha France asks, what are your thoughts on the ending of Bruce being with Selina in the end? Do you think the relationship was a little too predictable? I liked that relationship.
I liked that. It was the relationship between Bruce and what's her name?
Yeah,
Miranda Tate.
Utterly random and forced.
I thought there was a couple of scenes missing from that. I thought I was quite surprised that suddenly
you
they're
get
getting
a board
together.
Meeting to shagging on the carpet.
It was quite strange. And in retrospect, you can see that she's playing him, but the fact that he can't see that, maybe.
Almost everything she says second time around is very sinister. She's always talking about do whatever's necessary by any means possible. And it's kind of like, how could you not see this coming, Bruce?
The world's greatest detective.
Absolutely. But, you know, sometimes you can't see that which is too close to you.
Yeah. And he is vulnerable in this film.
Yes.
She does play on that.
Yeah.
She plays on his vulnerability. I mean, you know, she picks up the picture of Rachel.
She does.
Doesn't she? Before seducing
right
him. Right before seducing him. But I mean, the thing about, you know, she's never called Catwoman in this film, but, you know, the thing about Catwoman and Batman is there's traditionally always been a kind of
animal
relationship between them. And I've always been of the opinion that I always wanted those two to get together. She always seemed like the right choice in a weird way. So I really like the fact that this particular take on the Bat legend ends with them getting together.
Yeah, and they had real chemistry together as well.
Yeah.
Both in and out of their black tight leather costumes. Speaking of costumes, actually, Chris Laverty, who runs a fantastic blog called Clothes on Film, he has written a review of the film, which he's one of the guys who believes that the ending was a dream. But he makes an interesting point about Selina Kyle's costume at the very end of the movie. If you read his review, he basically says that throughout the movie she wears black, but in the final scene when Alfred sees them at the restaurant in Florence, she's wearing a blue dress, and he thinks that's an indication that it's a dream. I think it's the other way around. She's living in Gotham. She's surrounded by shadows. She's not who she wants to be. She wants to escape her old life. It makes sense for her to wear black. And then once she's in Florence, she wears a blue dress because she's no longer Selina Kyle. She's been given a clean slate.
Mm. I agree. I honestly, if we were to give credence to this frankly ridiculous dream idea, it wouldn't have been Selina Kyle, because as we said before, that doesn't make any sense.
True, but then who would have been? Rachel? A random woman? Would he have dreamt that?
Presumably a prostitute.
Yes. He's no money left, honestly. But it's still enough money
to
get to Florence.
How did he get to Florence? Hmm.
EasyJet.
EasyJet.
From Gotham.
Piloted by Tom Conti. There we go. That's the answer.
The 60-foot octopus. We're going to erase who these now. The 60-foot octopus.
What 60-foot?
I missed the 60-foot octopus.
I must have gone to this.
This guy has a real name. It's the name of the guy who's asking the question.
Oh, right. It's not actually the question.
He has a real name, but he wants to be known as a 60-foot octopus. He says, what's the significance of the autopilot? And could he escape the blast radius of 6 miles? Yes, he can. He's Batman.
No, I mean, who says he was even in the bat when it flew over the bridge?
Well, that's the thing. My wife has a theory that he bailed out over Gotham.
Yeah. He would have done.
Yeah, otherwise but he'd have had a long
Because there are a couple of shots of the bat hitting buildings. It looks like maybe no one's piloting it properly. Possibly.
Yes.
Possibly.
Interesting.
I was wondering when I was watching that scene.
Well, as he takes off.
It was kind of...
But when does he do it? But then again, he's Batman. He can appear and disappear at a moment's notice.
It's the answer to all questions. He's Batman.
Yeah. Hmm. Very, very quickly. Simon Cliff says, I didn't feel Commissioner Gordon's story was wrapped up particularly well. I disagree. But the blink and you'll miss a subplot about his wife leaving him was a mistake, in my view, given how his family have featured prominently in both previous outings. I really like that little touch, throwaway.
Yeah, me too.
That,
it's the cost. Yeah, it's the cost of fighting for Gotham.
And also a cost of the choice he made 8 years ago.
Yeah.
And how it's hit him hard emotionally. Yeah.
Also, if you're Commissioner Gordon's wife, and because of him, you'd been kidnapped with your children by a man with half his face melted off who was going to kill them, I think there might be a little bit of post-traumatic kind of relationship problem thing going on there.
There might be. And maybe Batman purists, comic book purists, are a little bit annoyed about that because, obviously Barbara Gordon in the comic books becomes a pretty significant character, and that doesn't really allow her the chance to do so.
But comic book purists think the Clayface and Man-Bat should be in this film.
Well,
so there you go.
One comic book purist in particular.
Yes. Well, the whole thing about the sewer. So Commissioner Gordon goes down into the sewer, is shot, and discovers the bad guy's lair, and he's completely disregarded by the rest of the police force.
Yeah, I think we've established that. To paraphrase the Strokes, Gotham City cops ain't too smart.
Right.
Yeah. Also, I think they want to turn a blind eye.
He's the police commissioner. Do you not think they're kind of obliged to listen when he says there's like a gang of mercenaries living under the city?
Yeah, but Nestor Carbonell's mayor just doesn't want to hear any of that stuff. They've had 8 years of relatively little crime in Gotham, and they don't want to hear that there's a master maniac living under the sewers building a small private army.
He wants to watch the football game.
I really liked all the stuff with the concrete. I think these movies, they may have plot holes. Not as many plot holes as The Dark Knight, though. But they're really intricately plotted. The whole thing with the concrete and explosives being layered in the concrete and Daggett. And I thought it was really, really nicely done. Very last question comes from Liam Oram, who asks very simply, how does Bane eat?
Smoothie.
Yeah. Each one of those little funnels has milkshake.
Yeah. Their smoothie goes in, and he has strawberry smoothie in one. And he has, I can't even think of smoothie flavours now.
But give me a banana and strawberry. Yes. There you go. Solved.
I think maybe he takes the mask off to eat.
Do you think? That would be extremely painful for you.
He's turned into Jar Jar Binks, doesn't
he? Yes, my Bane is essentially Jar Jar Binks with a little bit of Keith Lemon thrown in.
And Nyx is Sean Connery.
Nyx is the best one in the office.
I don't think so. I think mine is.
Okay. Let the games begin! That's pretty good.
That's pretty good.
I've been working on it for a week now.
Let the games begin!
That's terrible. Else, you're putting your hands over your mouth. Nick doesn't put his hands over his mouth, which is even more impressive. James.
Your punishment must be much more severe.
That's pretty damn good.
That's
pretty good.
I was just talking to you. That was...
It's a whole bald, muscly
thing.
Yeah,
that's right.
Terrifying.
Muscly.
Well, he's kind of muscly for a geek. He's quite muscly.
Compared to you, he is,
Compared to me, yeah. But compared to me, Thor of Herd is muscly. Anyway, that's all the time we have for our Dark Knight Rises spoiler podcast. I hope you've enjoyed it. Any more questions, do send them in. We'll try and address them in next week's podcast proper. Do download the other Dark Knight Rises podcast with the Christopher Nolan interview and have a good time, Gotham. See you later.